Hi, I'm Father Daniel Duplantis. In the 20th century, a new movement from the Far East captured the Western mind. Since then, the intersection of Christianity and martial arts has generated both conflict and harmony. In between, there remains many gray areas. In my new book, Jesus in the Dojo, I combine timeless theology with modern catechesis to provide a clearer path of reconciliation between the Christian faith and the practice of martial arts. You can find my book, Jesus in the Dojo, available now at most booksellers.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to No Earthly Explanation. This is the podcast where we investigate the things that are just unexplainable. For those of you who might be new to listening, I am your scientific host, Ellie Ringo of Ellie Knows Rocks. And with me, as always, is the ever brilliant Don Schmidt, our investigative host. Don, how are you doing today?
I am great, Ellie. Always wonderful to be with you and always excited about our next adventure, our next guest.
Our guest today is pretty cool. I've never met anybody like the person that we're going to interview today. So it's pretty cool. Our guest today is actually a reoccurring guest for the show and other podcasts. He's pretty popular. He is a Catholic priest. He's a chaplain, and he is a martial arts master sort of a person. His name is Father Dan. So Father Dan, welcome to our show.
Hey, it's great to be back. Yeah, absolutely. It's been a while, but yeah.
Well, awesome. It is so cool to have you here today. To get people started, I mean, this is my first time meeting you, and so thank you for being on here. But could you give us just a brief overview of your titles and what you do? Because, I mean, that's an impressive list of things. I mean, you could kick somebody's butt, and then you could save them all at the same time. So, I mean, that's pretty impressive.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. So, yes, I'm Father Daniel Duplantis. I'm a Catholic priest originally from the Diocese of Houma-Thibodaux in South Louisiana. I currently find myself in Anchorage, Alaska, as an Air Force chaplain on active duty at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. And so I'll pause right there for a little quick disclaimer. As an active duty chaplain, nothing I say in this podcast or anything that I do is endorsed by the DOD or the U.S. Air Force. They are simply my opinions and statements only. And so, yes, I'm an active duty chaplain, and I am a lifelong martial artist. So I have a fourth degree black belt in Jeet Do Kwan Taekwondo and a third degree black belt in Tang Soo Do. Funny little story about that. I was teaching a couple of students Taekwondo a few nights ago, and we're in the fitness center here on the installation, and two of the workers come in, and there's a storage closet in the room that we train in, and I asked them if they could leave the mats that they had in the front of the room there so we can do throws and things like that, and they said, "Oh my gosh, you're a black belt. You can mess someone up, can't you?" I said, "Yeah," but I said, I "You'll never guess my day job." And she says, "What are you?" I said, "I'm a chaplain." And she throws her hands up and she says, "I'm done. I'm just done." Chaplains, military chaplains, for some reason, we have, I guess, a stereotype that we can arrange meetings for people with the Lord in more ways than one.
Everyone's our audience a little bit more perspective. Taekwondo, you'd be talking about, that's the same form of martial arts that Steven Seagal is also a grandmaster, a black belt in, correct? Is that
I'm not familiar uses so much with his style, but Chuck Norris is a grandmaster in Tang Soo Do. In fact, he probably, of all the Hollywood actors, really made Tang Soo Do popular here in the U.S., having studied under Jaishul Chin, who was a first-generation Muay Thai student who came to the U.S. But Chuck Norris really kind of made it popular in the U.S. I think Steven Seagal was Tang Soo Do as well.
And Norris, he trained even under, considered the greatest of all, Bruce Lee. And Bruce Lee was mainly Kung Fu, correct?
Yes, that's correct. He actually founded his own style called Jeet Kune Do. Jeet Kune Do being a martial art that's famous for having the strengths of all martial arts possible and the weaknesses of none. It says designed to be an ever-evolving style where you take what works from every style and use that. So,
well, that's cool.
Yep. And Steven Seagal, I think, was Aikido.
Aikido. Yes, I stand corrected. Yeah. But I knew it was something outside of the general jujitsu, judo, karate, kung fu. So,
Aikido is a really interesting martial
art. You are, because it's a combination of different forms, correct?
Well, Aikido uses a lot of efficiency is really what it surrounds itself with, because you look at videos of people doing Aikido, or sometimes called Aikijujutsu, and it just looks fake, but most of the time it's not. If you get someone who's really good at Aikido and Aikijujutsu, they just make you look silly. It's just they know exactly how to minimize movement but maximize the energy efficiency to where they can just put you on your behind in the flick of a wrist, and literally the flick of a wrist. They just know how to do it, and I've been on the receiving end of it. And it's just incredible the people who do it. It's a really good Aikido person. I mean, you just so much as grab them, and they flick their wrist a certain way, but it's because they know how to really make their energy and their movements efficient. Least amount of movement possible, greatest amount of energy output.
Maybe that's something I need to learn. That sounds really cool. This is a totally brand new topic to me. I mean, I can do somersaults and cartwheels. That's like the extent of my whatever. I can also punch people, but probably not in the same way.
Yeah.
So you've got an interesting topic to talk to us about today. Namely, one of them being the Shroud of Turin. I am familiar with the term. I kind of know. I hope I said it correctly. But could you explain to us kind of the overview about this topic so we can get into some questions about it?
Yeah, the Shroud of Turin is a cloth. It's a burial cloth that has great popularity in the Catholic Church, especially, specifically because it is widely believed by many to be the actual burial cloth of Jesus, especially because if you look at the imprint on the cloth itself, you can very easily make out a person. You could see the face, you could see the body, you see the whole person imprinted into this burial cloth. And so especially if you see it as a photo negative, you really see the facial features come out. And so with that, it's not exactly confirmed or denied by the church, because, you know, of course, science says one thing and sometimes popular piety says another. It's dated to either the late 13th or early 14th century. Now, obviously, that's, you know, somewhere around 1300 years after the time of Christ. But there's all kind of like fringe theories as to if it is real, you know, why carbon dating wouldn't work and things like that. But it does hold, whether or not it's the real thing, it holds a very popular place in popular piety as an object of devotion for being what many people believe to be the actual burial cloth of Christ.
So what, and
as we know, the burial cloth is already mentioned, described to some extent in the Bible itself. It talks about the burial cloth. And as tradition, you know, at the time, within the Jewish faith, that was precisely what they would do with a corpse prior to burial. They would wrap the face, they would wrap the head, and then they would wrap as far as vertically the rest of the body. Now, isn't it true that based on the history of the shroud, that there was a fire around the date in question, and that there was a group of nuns that had repaired a portion of the shroud with new fabric. And that's the fabric, that's the portion of the shroud that was carbon dated, as a result, creating the false signal, the false impression that it only dated back to the 1500s. Or the fifth century. Is that correct?
That's often the claim that they make, that common fringe theory that's put out is the fact that that a piece of the repair was tested as opposed to the original cloth itself. So again, that's all very highly disputed. You know, and so it's very hard for the church to say, well, you know, to tell the scientists, well, you're doing something wrong, you know, whereas the church is in possession of the shroud, you know, so we can easily have scientists that we trust to do the carbon dating. And so it's kind of one of those things. And there's many things like this, at least in Catholicism, where the church will neither confirm nor deny, because in many cases, just like the name of this podcast, there's no earthly explanation for if this is the real thing, for how it could be, I guess, dated, you know, more recently than the time of Christ is. And so that, to me, if there was no earthly explanation, if I could think of a non-earthly explanation as to why that would be, my thought would be, if it is the real thing, then perhaps the shroud has qualities similar to the bodies of saints called incorruptibility, where you see the bodies of saints who they're not decomposing at the rate you would expect for either the time period or even just at all. Like, we still have the bodies of some saints, Padre Pio, who they look like they're sleeping. They look like they could wake up at any moment. And it's incredible to see how some of these saints' bodies are so well preserved. And again, it's not even so much the embalming methods. We can't explain how their corpses are so well preserved. And so that makes me wonder if the shroud, again, by miracles, by perhaps no earthly explanation, has that same quality.
What was the original, if you can answer this, like the purpose of laying a cloth over somebody? Was it just in reverence or to cover their body? Or was there a specific, this is why we're putting this on? And is it used continually throughout, I guess, holy figures?
As far as like the shrouding goes, that would just be part of the Jewish burial ritual. Again, part also because they would also use burial spices. I mean, we just celebrated Epiphany recently, and one of the gifts that the three magi brought was myrrh, which is an anointing oil, but specifically a burial oil. And you see, Nicodemus does this. Nicodemus in one gospel is bringing burial spices. You see Mary Magdalene, who's also coming to reanoint the body, in another gospel account. And so you see that, this concept of anointing the body, especially with perfumes, so that, you know, the corpse wouldn't smell so much. So I would assume that the wrapping also helps to keep the all the oils on the body. I would imagine they would, you know, they would anoint the body and then wrap it so that the oils are actually staying on the tissue itself, on the skin. And so that's, I would say, if there's any practical reason why they would do that, that would be it.
Well, that would make sense. General curiosity, but yeah, I'm very familiar with the Bible. I am not familiar with the Catholic religion or the intense parts of the Jewish religion, but I am very familiar with the Bible. But this is all very new information, so it's very fascinating.
the thing to emphasize is that it is human blood, as determined as far as on the shroud, as well as water, that the wounds of the figure on the shroud totally correspond with the wounds described as far as part of the crucifixion specifically of Jesus Christ, even down to the crown of thorns, even to the piercing of the side, which was not common as far as the Roman crucifixion at that time.
Right.
Because they would typically break the legs to keep the individual from being able to rise up and breathe for short periods of time as they would rest on the spikes through their feet. So the fact that the wounds directly correspond to everything described within the Bible. And I think that's one of the reasons that even the late Pope John Paul II, that he venerated the shroud, that he accepted it as being the genuine article, pictures of him as far as praying in front of it and saying that he himself was convinced it was authentic. And so I come back to you, Father Dan. Why do you personally believe? Because just imagine that the church would finally provide, as they do for miracles, as they have for visitations of the Blessed Virgin Mary, that they would finally, given now that we are over 20 years beyond the carbon dating, that the testing would be that much more accurate, that they wouldn't once and for all allow the dating to take place. And should it be confirmed to be 2,000 years old, that they could finally say, we endorse this relic of the church and we officially accept that this indeed is the burial Christ or the burial cloth of Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I certainly think
imagine
it's possible. Yeah.
Yeah, and they return back to the church.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is if it were dated to that period, then they would certainly have more of the certainty to say that this is the real deal, just as we would with like we have the relic of the Crown of Thorns. That's at Notre Dame in Paris. And then also the true cross that St. Helen, the mother of Constantine, mm-hmm. brought back from the Holy Land. You know, those relics the church believes are the actual things. In fact, the true cross was split into so many relic pieces and then has all those relics have been dispersed throughout the world. When I was in the college seminary, I studied under Benedictine monks. And at the monastery, they had one of those relics of the true cross that we were able to venerate for Good Friday. It's kind of one of those things. And this is, you know, where the church really steps in, you know, in relationship with the science to say, well, if the science is saying that it's dated to, 1,300 years is a long period of time, you know, after the time of Christ, then the church will certainly not go against that and say, well, this has to be the thing just because it looks like Jesus. It's got the church is going to be very careful in how it makes those pronouncements, especially because whether it is or it's not, does that change the dogma? Does it change what we believe as Christians? Not really. You know, it could be an item to help foster devotion, you know, and certainly it's already doing that. But that's where the church looks at that and says, is that a hill worth dying on, is for us to try to keep putting this off as the real thing, where if we can't prove it, does it change really the quality in terms of like the character of the faith itself? And they would say no.
Right.
Well, for just a scientific purpose, I mean, for dating it just on its own, you know, how many times have they dated it? Have they only dated one area? And if so, why haven't they dated micro parts of the entire thing, which it's not going to hurt its overall integrity, but to give an accurate carbon dating? I mean, 2000 years is not that long. You know, you can go back 14,000, you know, 20,000 years with carbon dating alone, just scientifically, and you get a very, very close to accurate number. So 2000 years is a blink of an eye for actual scientific data. So that it would be what I would think a very easy scientific thing to do, to go, hey, this is proven that this is the time frame that it came from, within, you know, very, very marginal aspects. So like, I'm really curious why that wouldn't be done, or if it's ever been talked about that it would be done.
Yeah, and that's the thing too, is as far as priests go, I'm very low on the totem pole, so I have no idea what the extent of the whole investigative process has been. You know, I would assume that if they're really true to, or really if their goal, if their aim is really to discern the truth, then I would assume that whoever was dating it would date probably certain parts of it, and not just, you know, because that's just what the scientific process does, right? Is you have your control, but then you also want to test different parts of it to make sure that you're testing it against the control, you know. So I love the point you make too. I mean, spoken like a true geologist, 2000 years is a blink of an eye, you know. Considering just how old our planet is, and you know, so yeah, it's amazing to see how that works. I would hope that maybe as technology continues to develop, that certainly the church would also continue to test it and just, you know, see where it goes. I mean, there's certainly other objects that we continue to test too, like the tilma for Guadalupe, you know, and just to make sure that their conditions, as we observe their conditions throughout time, you know, certainly warrants more testing. So, yeah.
No, I appreciate that answer. Thank you.
I was at a board meeting in Chicago at the very time that and there were a number of NASA scientists involved in the dating process. And because I was the lone Catholic on the board of directors, aside from one of the PhDs on our board, he was in phone communication with the team. He was speaking specifically to one of the NASA scientists. And he was giving me hourly reports as they were going through the procedure. And at one point he comes back, he says, "Don, they are totally befuddled as to what caused the actual scorch, the burning of the impression on the fabric, because it's on the surface. It hasn't penetrated the fabric in any way." And the one scientist from NASA made the comment, "It's as though there was a burst of energy that all at once transposed the impression, like a photograph of the body." And I said to the doctor, I said to him, "Like a body coming back to life?" And he said, "Exactly." And the point being that here we are in 2024, and science still cannot explain how that image was reproduced on that fabric.
Yeah,
as
that's
much as they would like to say, they can date it, they still can't scientifically explain how it happened.
Yeah. Yeah, that's where science is at the crossroads too, of, you know, the date says one thing, but then the question of, well, how did this get imprinted? You know, now we're talking about, again, no earthly explanation. because this is where, you know, you could try it as many ways as you can, but and it's the same thing too, because I think of not just that, but the similar process of how the image on St. Juan Diego's Tilma in Guadalupe came about too. Because how do you get that image? It's the same concept there, where you have this image that is somehow miraculously imprinted on this tilma, you know? So between, for both cases, there's really no natural explanation as to how you can get these images to imprint the way they have, you know? And that's the big kicker. That's, you know, again, probably maybe the biggest proof for this, if there is any proof for this being the actual burial shroud of Christ, is the fact that we can't explain how the image was put there. It's right, not right. Like it's just dried blood. There's more to it than that. Especially all the details, you know, the fact that it looks like it's literally like a photograph, like you said, of a person's body. And so I would say it's so evenly spread across the fabric.
Mm-hmm. And my mind runs wild with theories of things that could have happened with, like hard evidence, because that's where my brain goes to first, you know, without being able to explain it. That's hard to grasp, right? And that's why we're here, like, talking about it. But it's like, I know that, you know, he was spread with oil, he was spread with perfumes and that kind of a thing. And then, like, if you do that, say, to a towel, you know, just nowadays, say you have sun tanning lotion on and you sit on the towel, if that towel is left outside with that oil on it, it oxidizes for a little bit, and the UV rays actually create a small imprint on the towel. It's not like the image that we're talking about, but you can still see that there was definitely something there. And so that's where my mind goes about how could this have happened? And so the, you know, the explanations run wild, but it is completely unexplainable.
That's all been ruled out. They have tried hundreds of techniques in trying to recreate, as Father Dan said, it's like a photographic negative.
Yeah, it's insane.
And we cannot recreate that, even using a relief, using actual cadavers, as they have attempted. Uh-huh. And it was Barry Downing at Studio Macbeth when the History Channel had contracted them to do the 3D imagery of the man from the shroud. And actually, you know, let's see if everything corresponds to an actual crucifixion and execution, and how did this man actually look as a living human being at the time? And when Downing told me, he said, "I came into this, Don, as a total agnostic." He said, "I dropped to my knees and I cried like a baby when we saw under a microscope that there was also muscle tissue on the shroud."
Yep.
In other words, for a fake image, not only blood and water, but also muscle tissue.
Wow.
And so, again, you're talking about the greatest hoax of all time, or in my mind, the genuine article. I'm sorry. And the fact that science cannot explain how it got there. There's only one explanation left as far as I'm concerned.
There's no earthly explanation. That's a pure way to put it. This is a good segue, actually, into, I guess, our next topic with Father Dan. He's going to talk to us about stigmata.
Yes.
This is something that I'm like, it kind of blows my mind, but I know very, very little about. So could you introduce the topic for those that don't know what this is?
Yes. And it's funny because I didn't, really know what the stigmata were. And I'm a cradle Catholic. I was born and raised Catholic. I had never even heard the term stigmata until I think I was probably 17 or 18 years old. I was, I think, a senior in high school. And the only reason I had heard about it at that point was because the girl I was dating, her mom had found a movie on the stigmata. And she wanted us to watch it. So welcome to Catholic dating in South Louisiana,
Wow, that was fun. Here, let's sit down on the couch and watch this movie.
About stigmata, yeah. And then to see it, and it was about this, long story short, about this young woman who ends up having the wounds of Christ. And that's what the stigmata are. So the stigmata are, they're actually visible physical wounds that correspond to the wounds of Christ, often on the hands. Sometimes also the head as well, with a crown of thorns, wounds close to the heart where Christ was pierced by the lance, and sometimes also in the feet. There's also, I think, some that have been described as being like scratches on the back, like bleeding, actual bleeding scratches on the back that appear to signify like him carrying the cross. Mm-hmm. And so there's some very famous cases throughout history, especially, amongst canonized saints. The first one that we have really recorded is Saint Francis of Assisi, who founded the Franciscan Order.
Right.
He was a deacon, and so he is famous for having borne the stigmata. Some other famous cases were Saint Catherine of Siena, Saint Rita of Cassia, and then even more recent saints like Padre Pio,
who you mentioned also, earlier.
And then Saint Gemma Galgani, which Padre Pio has been kind of a name in the news recently because of the movie starring Shia LaBeouf, and Shia LaBeouf in his preparation for and then execution of that role of Padre Pio was actually just confirmed into the Catholic Church for New Year's.
Oh, wow.
It had a complete conversion by living with the Capuchin friars to prepare for, portraying Padre Pio, and then also just in the process of the movie itself. Yeah, he had a full-on conversion.
That's dedication.
And yeah.
What's interesting, Father, is you've mentioned men as far as who historically have experienced and been able to display publicly stigmata. I witnessed one personally in Mexico City and was able to sit with the very woman as the blood oozed from her hands and from her feet.
Yep.
And there was no clotting. I mean, the blood, it just kept bleeding. And isn't it true that most cases of stigmata are women?
They are, actually. The most famous cases, the two most famous ones are St. Francis of Assisi and Padre Pio. But when you look at like the list of perhaps really notable ones, a lot of them are women. Like I said, St. Catherine of Siena, St. Rita, St. Gemma. There was a saint who was canonized by Pope Francis back in 2019 who in India, and she had the stigmata. And so there is a very high percentage of them who are women.
So is this something that just happens randomly one day they wake up, or are they sitting there praying and it happens? How does it come about?
That's something, I guess, for more research. But oftentimes from what I hear, there's this association of a lot of it's prayer. This is something that I don't think God would just give to a random person, who wasn't willing to offer up a sacrifice, because that's basically what the concept is. It's basically, Jesus giving a sharing of the pain of his wounds to people who he knows can actually probably gracefully take it up. Right. Because what kind of God would he be if he just gave it to a random person who didn't ask for it? Not send, did ask for yeah. it, but wasn't willing to offer it up. And then it would, especially if this person was not disposed properly spiritually to doing so, to where they would just get angry with God for having it, you know? Whereas you look at the people who the church has recorded who have had the stigmata, and a lot of them are saints, canonized saints, you know? And even people who, you know, aren't canonized saints, because they can't be canonized saints until, you know, they're already in the grave. But, you know, for people where we've been able to study cases, certainly there's something just different about them. They're not like ordinary people. They certainly have this saintly and holy quality about them. Because again, the whole part of this is really sharing in Christ's suffering through those wounds. And so I imagine the person who receives the stigmata would have to be really, really spiritually open to doing so, you know. And Padre Pio, you know, I've seen the little kind of glove things that he would wear to cover his stigmata, and you see pictures of him all the time where he's got these kind of fingerless gloves, because they would just bleed, especially in you know, when he's celebrating Mass. And so there was always a correspondence to you know, between the wounds themselves and also the celebration of Mass, because that's where the bread and wine become the body and blood of Christ. And so it's amazing to kind of see those connections there. But yeah, I'd say certainly they have to be spiritually open and willing to offer such suffering.
Okay, this is a dumb question. And I apologize in advance for asking.
Go for it.
how long does this continue? Do the people heal or do they die from it?
I don't think they die from it. But certainly people like Padre Pio, like, had it until the day he died. Mm-hmm. You know, and so that certainly seems to be the case, is that once it's received, I don't think it necessarily goes away. It sounds like it's something the person lives with the rest of their life.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's insane.
But after they die, there are cases where the wounds then heal or they regress. Is that correct?
Probably. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing too, is a lot of this, you know, there's so much more of this that can be researched, and it depends what sources you find. But from what I understand, a lot of them have been where they take those wounds to the grave with them. But then, like you said, you know, I mean, we're talking about, you know, all kind of things with no earthly explanation here, where, you know, if they close up, wow, you know, it just goes to show that, you know, they're doing that to share in that suffering on earth. You know, especially to offer that suffering for other people. And then once that purpose is finished, you know, yeah, I think it's an amazing thing if those wounds heal up like that at death, simply because the purpose is done with.
And it's not like they are life-threatening. It isn't as though they become infected. In fact, isn't there even an odor, a pleasant odor associated with the stigmata? What is it called? The odor of a sanctity?
Yeah, usually something like that. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
It's kind of hard to describe, again, because it's, you know, we don't know exactly what it is, but you're right. There's, you know, and same things too, like with Marian apparitions, you know, people always, you know, associate the smell of roses with Mary, you know, and just at different moments where, you know, like at different apparitions of the Blessed Mother, or just different times where people are close to death and praying the rosary, you know, and they smell roses, you know, same kind of thing with the stigma. Mm-hmm. They do have these, our senses are certainly engaged, you know, by encounters with the divine. And I think that's always such a beautiful thing about faith, you know, is the way that God engages us in our entirety, all of our senses.
Wow.
And quickly, Ellie, I don't mean to interrupt, but continuing on the same theme. And then isn't there also a strong desire during the experience for Holy Communion?
Yeah, probably so, because
for
someone like Padre Pio, again, you know, when they really started bleeding from his hands during the celebration of Mass. And so, yeah, there's always that connection with people who have the stigmata to receiving the body and blood of Christ, because that's kind of what in their own bodies they're actually emulating, is the body of Christ, the wounded body of Christ. And bleeding as he bled, you know? So, yeah, I don't think that's a coincidence that there's that correspondence there. Yep.
Oh my gosh. That, I'm slightly speechless, so I apologize. But also, I do hear that you have a book. Is this true?
Yes. And it's funny because the last time I think I was on the show was right about a year and a half ago. And I was just in the planning phases of the book. In fact, one of the things that when we finished the episode, you know, I had asked Don, you know, as someone, you know, who's he himself has wrote so many books, you know, what should I be doing as a first time author, you know, things to do and things not to do. And so, yeah, so here's the completed work right here in my hands. I know this is going to be an audio podcast, but yeah, here's the book. It's called Jesus in the Dojo, A Christian Pedagogy of Martial Arts.
That's a beautiful cover.
Yes.
Todd did a phenomenal job with this. Like, I remember when he sent me the proof and I looked at it for the first time and I was like, it's perfect. Oh my gosh, it's perfect. So, you know, shout out to Todd Fisher for, you know, for making really this come to life. Yes, it's a book on basically how to reconcile the practice of martial arts with especially Christian spirituality, and not just spirituality, but also philosophy and theology, especially in terms of, you know, self-defense, double effect, a lot of these kind of gray areas where, you know, the concept of fighting and violence can find itself at odds with Christianity. So it's a way of kind of navigating through those gray areas. So it's available on Barnes and Nobles and Amazon, as well as the Metacortex Publishing website. And again, it's called Jesus in the Dojo.
Awesome. Thank you for that. That's really cool.
Yeah.
I have to ask, because the idea that you and I both having been raised Roman Catholic, I went to parochial school. I mean, I was taught by the nuns. I played baseball with nuns, the younger ones who just love to get out and be tomboys, you know, with the local, you know, children, that type of thing. I love the wonderful memories and experiences. But the idea that having been raised Roman Catholic and with that level of piety and things that we had drilled into us that now have stood the test of time, it's something that we live each and every day, whether we went into holy orders or not. I mean, it's something, it's a lifestyle. And that's what I appreciate about it the most. And I thank my parents every day that they carried on their faith through us in that regard. And so the very concept that I remember when I was with actor Martin Sheen, and we were on a movie set together, and he was raised Catholic, long lifetime Catholic, but he had fallen away. And he was filming in Italy. He was filming in Rome. He was portraying a priest. And a cardinal friend at the Vatican, he posed the question. He said, I just need an answer to this once and for all. If you can give me one word that distinguishes Catholics from all other faiths, what would you say? And the cardinal said, forgiveness. And so that's where, and he said he's never looked back. He said that he went right back to the church, and it's like, that's all I needed to hear. And so, but the idea of turning the other cheek, forgiveness, but yet even in your capacity in martial art, the idea that even Jesus became angry, that even Jesus momentarily became violent in overturning as far as the money changers' tables.
Yeah.
So it can be applied in such a manner in which, if that's what it takes to get your attention, like the old saying, if it takes a 2x4 between the eyes, if that's what it takes to get you, you know, listening, so be it. And so I believe it's a wonderful combination of the two, that when it's applied with forgiveness, when it's applied with love. And that's why I think the very concept of the book, it's unique. It's something different. And we wish you so well with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, beautifully said.
Father Dan, is there something that you would love to tell everybody if you could encourage anybody or say something that you would want to, what would it be?
Oh boy. Yes. And it's something I think of all the time. Just in reflecting on my own life, my own experience, you know, especially, you know, if you're a person of faith, you know, just, you know, always say yes to the Lord, you know, always say yes to God, wherever he asks of you, because, I found that, you know, that yes is a double-edged sword. There have certainly been very difficult moments, for me as a priest, but that everybody has difficult moments in every, path that they walk. But specifically, if you give that yes to the Lord, buckle up, because he's going to take you on a roller coaster. Because, you know, I look back at everything that's happened, especially just for me since I got ordained a priest, you know, and everything that's brought with it. And I never would have imagined, I turned 30 in May, that by the time I turned 30 years old, you know, I would be where I am doing the things that I'm doing. And I'm like, holy cow, and all this is because I said yes. You know, so, and then also with that, dream big. You know, I think if I can, you know, go back and I've always said, especially with the last year that I had, 2023, and Todd will tell you too, 2023 was a big year for me. 2023 is the year that I wish I could go back and tell my high school self, you know, my high school self that was getting ready to graduate, getting ready to take on the world, and say, Dan, you did it. In fact, you more than did it. You know, and that's because I think, you know, when I was in high school, like, I dared to dream big. I dared to, you know, to want big things for me so much as they fit in with God's will. You know, so yeah, dare to dream big, and dare to say yes to the Lord, because as long as anytime those two things intersect, it's extremely rewarding and extremely fulfilling.
That is amazing. I absolutely love that. And I'm sure that our listeners are really going to appreciate it as well.
Awesome. Thank you.
And even at the age of 30, that you already can look back and say a life well lived, but you're just getting warmed up.
Yeah.
You're just getting warmed up. You're just getting warmed up. We know that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I feel like, you know, if heaven forbid I die young, but if I did, certainly, you know, I'd have no regrets. You know, I'd certainly be happy with, you know, whenever my time is to say, hey, I feel like I've lived several lifetimes in 30 years, and I wouldn't take back anything of it. I wouldn't add anything to it. Everything else is just, it's a blessing at this point, you know, so absolutely.
Well, Father Dan, where can people find you if they want to get a hold of you or follow you or check in on what you're doing?
Yeah, so I have a Facebook and Instagram site that's The Karate Priest, so you could find The Karate Priest on either of those. I have a podcast also called The Karate Priest. We're on hiatus right now, but we will hopefully be planning to do season 3 soon. But if you want to catch up on seasons 1 and 2, that's on Spotify. It's distributed by Spotify, but you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts. There's all kind of platforms out there. If you have a podcasting platform, more than likely the podcast is there. That's called The Karate Priest. And then also, if you go to Metacortex Publishing's website as well, you can find information on the book, on any bookings as well. So if people want to book me for talks and things like that, I'm mostly virtual right now since I'm active duty, but I'm happy to do Lent missions, parish missions, things like that. And all that information you can find at metacortexpublishing.com.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. That's about all we have for today, guys. I really appreciate you all listening. And please be sure to rate and review this episode. It really, really helps people find us. And be sure to look us up on Facebook and Instagram at No Earthly Explanation. And if you would like to find and follow Don, you can find him on Facebook at Donald Raymond Schmidt. If you'd like to find and follow me, you can find me on all social media platforms at Ellie Ringo or at Ellie Knows Rocks. And if you guys want to email us and have any questions, comments for this episode, or even let us know what you'd like to hear on future episodes, you can email us at noearthlyexplanation.com. Thank you guys so much for listening. And Father Dan, thank you so much for being our guest. You're awesome. And I hope you can continue to kick butt and save people.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And it's certainly the reason that you're a reoccurring guest, and that you're not only well-read on many topics as far as regarding the church and faith in general, but now as a fellow author, that we hope this is also just the first of many writing endeavors, and you'll see that you'll be invited for lectures not only throughout the United States but around the world, because you certainly come highly regarded from us. And once again, we wish you all the success with your new book.
Right. Thank you.
Metacortex Publishing hopes that you've enjoyed this presentation.
Please take a moment to listen to some other podcast offerings from Metacortex Publishing.
Hi, I'm Father Daniel Duplantis, a Catholic priest, martial artist, and host of the Karate Priest podcast. Have you ever wondered what the church teaches about different topics? Are you a martial arts enthusiast or just someone who wants to learn more about martial arts? I'd like to invite you to join me and many guests on my podcast as we cover topics of faith, everyday living, and martial arts on the Karate Priest podcast.
I'm Amber Rose, the religious hippie, and I host the podcast A Catholic's Perspective. Join me every 2 weeks as I release episodes targeted towards helping young Catholics navigate their ever-changing secular world while staying strong in their faith. Whether you are a Catholic or not, all are welcome here. So if this is something that interests you, feel free to tune in. You can find A Catholic's Perspective on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I hope to see you there. Bye!
A quest is a search for something. And every week, the Quest podcast will show you how we know what we know through interviews with people that have incredible stories of dedication and perseverance. I'm your host, Todd Fisher. Join me in this thought-provoking and inspiring podcast of discovery. Find us anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Todd Fisher and Anthony Smith and is distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for Metacortex Publishing at metacortexpublishing.com or find us on social media for other unique content.